Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week I bring what I feel is people who are involved in the ongoing revolution of spirit in this country. And one of the founders, I think, of this movement is tonight's guest. His name is Leonard Orr. He's founded Rebirthing. He has been investigating physical immortality for the last 30 years, and he has a lot of insight into improving the quality of our life and achieving a level of consciousness that everyone is striving to achieve on these higher levels. So, Leonard, thank you for being the guest tonight.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
I want to go over. Leonard was just in New York, and we did a very nice salon there with someone else who's also been investigating physical immortality and. Physical immortality, for those who don't know it, is a truth. It's a possibility. And Leonard, could you just talk about some of the great sages you've met, and the ages, and the condition they were in, and how they lived?
Yes. Well, I was interested when I went to India. I was interested in finding immortal yogis, and my arbitrary minimum for longevity was 300 years. They had to be at least 300 years old for me to be interested. And I've met about eight of those people, ranging from 380 to several thousand years in the same body.
How were you able to actually find them? I mean, they don't show up for everybody. I'm sure a lot of people went to India trying to find them. How did you find them?
Well, actually, after some of the immortals that I have met were no longer available in a convenient way, they went into the Himalayas or whatever, I sent a very good friend of mine from Venezuela to Rishikesh, and I told him to ask around at the temples for immortal yogis. And after asking around, I mean, most of the priests in the temples had no idea what he was talking about and didn't, you know, believe that such a thing existed. But paradoxically, he actually found a businessman in a store that said, okay, you have to hike about 2 days into the Himalayas. And I believe that person accompanied him and took him to an immortal yogi in the Himalayas. And he had a very profound experience. As soon as he met this yogi, the yogi told him everything about him, including this friend of mine was a multimillionaire, and he told this friend that he had too much stuff. And when he got back to Venezuela, he found out that a lot of his construction machinery had been stolen. He was there. And so that definitely impressed the message that this immortal yogi gave him very deeply into his consciousness.
Well, we'll get into how that's achieved, but it seems like the wisdom of that kind of psychic insight and some of the cities, the powers, goes along with that kind of age. Is that true? Like, once you achieve...
Yeah, well, I mean, as our consciousness expands, as we break through one limitation after another, and that's probably the most powerful motivation for becoming immortal, is just to get rid of our limitations.
Yeah.
And to realize more of our divine potential. And physical immortality, it's interesting to think about, and it expands the mind. It kind of breaks us out of our rational construct of limitation. But if you think about it, physical immortality is impossible because the end of immortality never comes.
So right,
we
well, we're all physically immortal in this moment, wouldn't you say that?
Well, yeah, one of the affirmations that I made 30 years ago was that we're immortal until we prove otherwise. In other words, until we kill ourselves.
Exactly.
But the fact is that we can never say that we've achieved it. In that sense, it's the perfect religion because there's no possibility of hypocrisy, because if you're a hypocrite, you die.
Right. Right,
and you're
right.
Exposed to the world, and you can never achieve the goal because, by definition, it's immortal.
Right, but I, of course, and there are those. There are things that you've investigated that someone can do to put themselves on the path to that immortality.
Yes, after I met five or so of these immortals that had lived for hundreds or thousands of years, I asked myself, what are the common denominators in their daily life that enable them to master the body, to master the mind and the body? And so I came up with fundamentally six principles. I delineate them as six and as seven and as nine, but it's actually a pretty limited number of very simple concepts or spiritual practices that can enable us to master our mind and body. And so to give you those six, the first one is working with the mind itself. In other words, raising the quality of every thought as it flows through our consciousness. And one of the ways of doing that is to work with a mantra.
Right.
And number two is to practice harmony in our relationships, to respect the natural divinity and the reality of everybody else, no matter how convoluted it is, and sometimes respecting the reality of other people involves separating ourselves from them. But to practice love and harmony in our relationships as much as possible, that's a fundamental principle, and to learn how to clean and balance the energy body with earth, air, water, and fire.
With the five elements, four elements. Well,
yeah, and so water is bathing twice a day. I notice that all the immortal yogis bathe twice a day.
Uh-huh.
Even though they don't have bathtubs and warm water and showers. And they learn conscious energy breathing, also known as prana yoga.
They do that every day, too, the pranayama.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fundamental to mastery of the mind and the body. It induces profound relaxation, including peace and bliss, and also fills the body and the mind with divine energy.
Wait, can I just ask you about the water one before you go on? It's they bathe twice a day because we collect energy, like negative energy on our etheric body, and washing cleans that off. It's not for cleanliness necessarily.
Yeah, not for physical cleanliness, although that also is involved, but especially depending upon where you live, I mean, you can get ticks or, you know, whatever kind of organisms that could be harmful to the body, and when you strip naked and you bathe, then you can see that your body is just fine physically.
Right.
But the real value of it is to clean the energy body, which is invisible except to those who become aware of it.
Right. Right. Okay, so go ahead.
All the ones that I met are vegetarians, and they also do extensive fasting. And so they basically, you have to ask the question, what kind of nutrition does my body actually need to maintain its health and strength? And so yoga means the science of life, which involves experiments, and so it's necessary to constantly do nutritional experiments in order to find what's really best for us. Mm. And then exercise or movement is the other part of the earth category. Mm-hmm. And then finally there's fire. Fire burns away the death urge and persistent negative emotions more efficiently than the other elements, and it works perfectly together with bathing. Fire flows up and water flows down, and they're the polar opposites of each other, and they each contribute to the health of the energy body in a very powerful and unique way.
So how, when do you set the, during at the fire? Only at night or as much as you can? When would you do the fire?
Well, in my experience, I completely burned out and became non-functional in 1981, and I spent 5 to 10 hours with the fire every day for a year in order to rehabilitate myself. And so the amount of time that we spend with the fire is determined by our lifestyle and our personal needs and energy and tension that we've collected. So each person has to experiment in order to find out what they need in order to stay in top form.
But it's probably great to sleep by a fire, isn't it?
Yeah, since I learned that about fire, I slept with the fire every night since 1981. And I'm actually in front of my fireplace right now.
Oh, great. I'm in front of my heater in New York. But the thing about the fire burning away the death urge, you might want to talk about what the death urge is, but also how that actually energetically works. How would fire affect our internal psychological attachment to something, well, that unconscious? But how do the two work like that?
Okay, well, first of all, I sleep in front of my fireplace every night, but I also need to go a few times a week outside and have a totally open fire. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, I notice that the fire, that there's like a band of energy around my body, mainly in the solar plexus area. And when I'm with a totally open fire, I can feel like the fire burning a hole in this band of energy, and it just falls away.
Uh-huh. Well, you're sensitive to that, so...
Yeah, and so it takes enough practice to be sensitive to those things, and so everybody has to do enough practice until the secrets of the fire are revealed to them through their own scientific experiment.
Uh-huh. I see. So... You've been doing fire for probably almost 40 years now, so you really understand what the fire has to teach you.
Right.
So how does it affect... Yeah, oh, go ahead.
27 years. Since
27 years. So how does it affect the death urge? How does it affect our psychology?
Well, human consciousness is composed of mental mass, which I also call emotional energy pollution. And we can actually learn things from other people without any verbalization of what we're learning. We can learn structures of thought or feelings, and we can absorb feelings and energy concentrations from other people without even perceiving it with the rational mind. And one of the goals of spiritual purification is to get sensitive enough so that we note what we're taking on from other people.
Right. Well, I notice that if I'm around people that have a really heavy energy, I feel that. I think more and more people are feeling that, so I understand that, absolutely.
Right. And so then, after you have that experience and you feel overloaded, if you go spend time with the fire, you will notice that the pain or the heaviness just dissolves.
Mm.
And then if you follow that up by soaking in the water, you can be totally back in top form.
If we don't have a fire, can we use a candle? Does that work?
Well, I recommend a candle meditation in which people set up 12 candles and light one, meditate on the result, then 2, meditate on the result, 3, etc., all the way up to 12. And most people, somewhere between 1 and 12, will experience a very measurable result.
Uh-huh.
And that's the minimum amount of candles that they need in order to get that benefit. And when people are using fire and candles, it's important that they have metal candle holders, and I also always get a big metal pizza tin, and I set the candle holders in the pizza tin, and that way the wax drips in the pizza tin and it creates a safe situation. If people
right.
have pets, of course, they should never leave the room when a candle is burning.
Right. The thing about the death urge, if we want to talk about that, if a child was brought up without any conditioning like that, would the death urge still be imprinted, or would they be free from that?
Well, that's a great study in itself.
Yeah.
And obviously, if that were true, there would be more immortals around.
Right, right.
And
right.
people must be learning the death urge from someplace, and as a result of working with thousands of people over the years and watching people actually heal the death urge, which they learn from their family tradition, it can be pretty tricky and complicated. For example, some people have worked through their death urge spontaneously before they even met me. And as a result of hearing me talk about it, they realized what they did, what they went through.
Well,
and that was a great, helpful revelation to them.
But
and
how do you know when... Yeah, go ahead. Other people...
And other people can't seem to unravel the death urge until after their parents die, because the death urge is not active, and they're not miserable enough to be motivated to do enough work with the philosophy of physical immortality and the psychology of physical immortality and the practices in order to heal it.
Well, how do you know when you've worked through the death urge? How do you know when you've met someone and they have?
Well, they have unusually clear energy and they have a natural form of spiritual enlightenment and a very expanded perspective on life.
Now, would they still die if they've worked through the death urge? I mean, or are they still around, all the people you've met who, or do they have to, is it a constant like polishing of the crystal in a way?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
And the answer really has to do with the individual's lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
Because if people are not constantly being re-injected with the death urge from other people, depending upon how they participate in the world, then we don't know what's possible. I just read an article, I don't know if you've seen that article, about two brothers in France whose parents and grandparents knew these young adults, and they were young adults evidently century after century, and they would move from city to city and develop new relationships and a new identity, and when you know the situation got uncomfortable for them, they would just change their location and their relationships and the whole works.
Oh, so they were immortal, these young people. But you're saying, like you said earlier, so even if you've cleaned your death urge, if you come in contact with people who haven't, you're going to pick something up subconsciously or energetically, and you've also said people are the most dangerous things on the planet because of that, right?
Yeah, the human mind is the most dangerous thing in the universe.
So if you've unraveled your death urge, if you've healed it, and you then went off by yourself and never, you know, associated with that, you'd probably be an immortal then, right?
Yes, however, we have to heal more than the death urge, and the advantage of participating in society is that it stimulates other things that need to be healed. And so as long as we do enough spiritual practices to burn away the death urge that we are in contact with, that we get injected with, then we just have to develop a balance that works for us personally, mm-hmm. so that we can stay clear and in top form.
Oh, so the other things we have to heal then are our miasms, our genetically distorted genes, let's say. Or is that what you're talking about, the other things that we have to heal?
Well, yeah. I mean, genes is a mental structure.
Well, the things we've inherited, you know, in the homeopathic tradition, when you have a miasm, it predisposes you to certain types of illnesses, and maybe they are a mental structure, but they seem to be locked down. And I mean, that's what my theory would be of these other things. What are you talking about, these other things that have to be healed?
Yeah, well, we have to heal whatever we have accumulated from our family tradition, the karma of our soul, which involves, you know, previous lifetimes, stuff that we haven't healed yet, and the results of our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Have three potential sources, and those three potential sources, how many people do you know are even asking the question or even working on it?
Well, no, not many, absolutely not. I agree. But
right.
Around the people we hang out with, maybe there's a lot more.
Yeah, and so then people have to work on all three of those categories, mm-hmm. and it takes as long as it takes, and it takes whatever experiences that it takes, and we have to endure whatever physical symptoms are produced by those three causes mm-hmm. and learn to heal them.
I mean, are you still working through your stuff? And you keep re-injecting yourself back in the world, too, so you're probably picking up a lot of things out there as well.
Well, I do enough practices so that I am pretty well ahead of the game. The game,
right.
The game of spiritual purification. And so, whenever I get overdosed with emotional energy pollution from the world, then I just know I have to spend more time alone doing the practices. And then I get back in top form, and it's really fun to go out in the world and accomplish things and get all dirty again.
and also help people with their I mean, you're doing it as a service to the planet.
Right.
Those who want to listen. So,
right, because when you're totally clean, there's nothing to do but get dirty again. And when you're totally dirty and non-functional, there's nothing to do but get clean again.
Yeah, but you've talked about these immortal yogis not wanting to see anybody and just stay away from that emotional pollution altogether when you reach a certain level, right?
Well, that kind of extreme asceticism, I don't know that I support. And Babaji, who I met in a 9,000-year-old body, he has always taught spiritual community, even if it's a group of ascetics out in the Himalayas, he has always taught that community is an important element for ultimate healing and self-realization. I think that there's a point when asceticism is self-defeating.
I understand that, and I do think even now more than ever we're moving into a collective mind, so I don't think we actually can separate ourselves from other people anymore. The consciousness is getting too interwoven, and you know, we're all part of one great consciousness anyway, so it's an illusion to think that we can be separate.
Well, I think that we obviously can, and if positive people don't illustrate that, definitely stupid people do.
Right. But talk a little bit more about Babaji. I mean, if someone wanted to meet Babaji, if I wanted to meet Babaji, would he come to me? Would I have to go and find him? There's that... The mantra that Yogananda talks about, you just say Mahavatar Babaji, and actually you do get a rush of energy when you say that particular mantra. But how would I go about finding him, or someone who's really intent on having that meeting?
Well, just continue working with that mantra until it happens.
So that is the key, that mantra.
Well, yeah, or Om Namah Shivaya. The fact is that if you bother Babaji enough, sooner or later he'll satisfy you in order to stop being bothered.
They'll say, okay, I'm coming, stop calling my name, right? And so the Babaji you met, there was one 9,000, but there was another one who had a body of a younger boy, the Harikon Babaji, who actually didn't become an immortal. I mean, what happened with Harikon Babaji that his body died, and yet he was still claimed to be immortal? I don't quite understand that whole thing.
He stopped his heart and had his body buried on Valentine's Day of 1984. Mm-hmm. And in September of 1984, he wrote me a letter from Nepal.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I'm well and happy in Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he left the ashram because of the scandals of ashram life. And he said that the five elements of his body never die, and to reconstitute them is a great experiment of yoga.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first time that he did that.
Oh, really? In 9,000 years was the first time?
No, that's not the first time.
Oh, that's not the first time in 9,000 years.
Right. When I printed that letter, which I received from him in my Physical Immortality book, which Babaji edited, and I added that page after he edited it. But on that page, I tell the story of him in the 1920s when he took a devotee of his named Joshi on a spiritual pilgrimage to Badrinath. And after they were gone a couple of days on the journey, the devotee developed cholera and dysentery and was destined to die.
Uh-huh.
And Babaji said, you have a family, it's better for me to die than you. And as soon as he said that, the symptoms left the devotee's body and overtook Babaji's body. And Babaji said to the devotee, Josie, that when I leave my body, I would like you to burn my body and put the ashes in the river.
Uh-huh.
So when he left his body, the devotee burned Babaji's body and put the ashes in the river. And so how would you feel if you were him and your disease killed your guru?
Well, I'm sure he had confidence that he could reconstitute that body.
Well, no, he didn't. Not at all.
Oh.
And so then he was so struck with grief that he abandoned the pilgrimage to go to Badrinath, and he went home. And when he got home, a neighbor came over and said, Babaji's holding darshan in a friend's house. Would you like to come? And Josie said, well, that's not possible. I myself watched him die and burned his body and threw the ashes in the Ganges.
Mm-hmm.
And so the neighbor finally convinced him to come and meet Babaji. And so when he did actually go to Babaji and received his darshan, he was temporarily insane for 6 months.
But it makes sense. When you reach that level of high consciousness, it seems anything is possible.
Babaji has been known for centuries to be a total master of bilocation.
Right.
And when you think about that incident, you can see how much love Babaji has for us, that he's willing to manifest an alternative body and die and have that body burned in order to liberate us from our illusion.
Now, is what Babaji achieved, it seems like it would be possible for each human being to achieve that same greatness. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is, and Babaji definitely recommends that.
Right. So, and you are one of the people laying out those pathways to achieving that, And I guess, you know, having met Babaji is of great assistance. So he's out there to be met still in any, in some form or another.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of immortal beings. I mean, the Divine Mother appears to people too. What's your connection with that energy? And have you met that divine feminine presence in a form?
Well, I've met her in the form of Kali.
Oh. The black-headed, fiery goddess, yeah.
Well, actually, she appeared to me as a beautiful, beautiful black young woman.
Uh-huh. And how did you know it was Kali?
Well, they tell you.
They tell you with
words, but they can just reveal themselves into your mind.
And then what was the nature of that interaction? I mean, did she appear to you for a reason, or?
Yeah, she definitely blew my mind.
Well, was this recently?
That was about 15 years ago.
Because the stories of this divine feminine essence appearing, you know, as Mary all over the world, as Isis in Egypt, as White Buffalo Cap Woman in Native American legend, I think it's all the same presence, it seems to me. I mean, the markings are the same. There's usually a type of smell of roses, and then this being gives you a boon, an object, and actual physical object of sorts. So that seems to be common throughout all these appearances that I've been able to track. Is that true in your research?
Well, they definitely give you lessons and
explain. But an actual object of physical manifestation is also given sometimes. I mean, not all the time, but I'm just wondering, is that this same presence that is appearing all over, like it's the same Babaji, or are those different beings?
Well, they're different beings. And all beings are the same presence. So
right.
We have to struggle with that.
I mean, don't you think there have probably been civilizations on the planet that just been able to achieve that in mass, maybe the Anastasis of the Southwest or maybe the high minds, and just were able to transcend this reality with their bodies?
Yeah, I think there's some groups. I think that after Enoch, in fact, when Enoch, he evidently dematerialized twice, and the second time, I think, was in Avery, England, and he took, according to the Book of Mormon, it says that he took 40,000 people with him. But that wasn't necessarily a good move, because then human history took a turn for the worse. And
when was that? What year was that, would you say?
Enoch. It was, you know, between Enoch, and then there was Noah.
Uh-huh.
And then we have the flood to destroy people.
Uh-huh.
Human history degenerated very rapidly at that point. So taking the high beings off the planet through transfiguration is not necessarily a good idea.
It seems like there's still structures that are in place that help support the transfiguration. I mean, I think we're heading towards that time. Maybe 2012 is part of this collective transfiguration. But I think structures like the Great Pyramid, maybe the Pyramid at Chichen Itza, accelerate our spiritual process because of the way they're built.
Yeah, well, from my study and research, it's easier to dematerialize than it is to totally master the mind and the body. And in fact, I have a good friend who lives in Virginia who remembers being Mirabai in her previous life, and she dematerialized in that life. And when she came across my physical immortality book, she said, this is the answer. Dematerialization didn't really solve the problem.
Where do you go when you demon? I mean, you're moving from this point. Where's the other point that you appear?
Well, you appear where all beings appear when they leave the body, which is called the spirit world or various dimensions of heaven.
But isn't that an immortal dimension? If you could go to that place, don't you achieve that level of higher consciousness and have mastered the body? I mean, it seems like if you could dematerialize, it's a mastering of the physical realm.
But it doesn't necessarily involve mastering the mind.
Uh-huh.
And the people that did dematerialize, they left mainly out of frustration. They didn't leave for the highest motive.
I see.
And it may be that humanitarianism is the highest motive that we are capable of achieving.
Well, I think it's true, because I think in the books of Carlos Castaneda, he was able to dematerialize at one point, but he wasn't able to master the mind and the body like his teacher Don Juan did. So I think I agree with you with that, yeah. So, I mean, talk about these. When you meet someone who's thousands of years old, what's it like to be in that presence? I mean, if you can get the negative stuff from people, you must be able to get like this positive energy from these people.
Yeah, well, when I was in the presence of Babaji, I felt empty space. When I was in the presence of Bhartraji, who is 2,000 years old, his presence felt like a feather. And when I was driving back to Delhi after meeting him, I said to myself, this guy, it was like I was in the presence of a guy who'd been working on himself for 2,000 years. And then I laughed because, yes.
He's still working on himself after all that time, huh?
Right, uh-huh.
So it takes at least 2,000 years to get yourself clear of all your junk, huh?
Well, in his case, it took him about 700 to become a total master of the physical body, at least.
So what do you feel you have left to master? I mean, you're working, I mean, if you want to share that with us, what is it?
Well, Bhartraji mastered his body in about 700 years, and I haven't mastered... I haven't met anybody who did it in less than 500.
Uh-huh. So you're just a child, really, in that, you know. You're under 100, so.
I'm still breaking all kinds of limitations.
Right. I see. But are there other people out there doing the same work that you're doing that you know of?
Yeah, thousands.
Have you ever met Jazz Muheen, who doesn't eat?
Yeah, she's a good buddy.
Yeah, I think she's achieving a level of living on prana and going into that realm. So there are some people doing that. So you also created rebirthing as the connective breathing process. Now, does that fit in? Pranayama does, but how does rebirthing fit into clearing these deep levels in ourselves that bring us back to the death urge?
Well, it's known as the queen of yoga, and it's the ultimate technique. However, it doesn't. The value of it gets lost if we don't work with the other elements. So breathing What I've noticed in rebirthing breath workers, is that if they don't do spiritual purification, they kind of, their breathing gets blocked.
Uh-huh.
And
so they need to do the other things.
Fast, or they need to spend the day with the fire, whatever it takes in order to absorb enough prana from the physical universe, which is eternal, right? It is immortal. Physical universe is immortal, and it's the interplay of earth, air, water, and fire. And so we have to imitate the nature of the universe itself by having a conscious, practical relationship with earth, air, water, and fire in order to keep ourselves in top form.
Well, what do you think of sexual energy? It seems like it's the most alive. It's the hottest. How do immortals deal with that? Do they have sex, or are they celibate? Or what's your ideas about that?
Well, they have many different lifestyles in relation to that, and of course the quality of the tantric energy that you experience in sexual orgasm is determined by the quality of your partner.
Right.
And having sex with the wrong partner can totally debilitate you.
Right. But you can also use it to increase this life force energy.
If you do it with the right partner.
Yeah. And if you do, is there a certain way, I mean, if you have the right partner, is there certain ways of doing it that, there are tantric practices, but anything that you recommend?
Well, yeah, I mean, people can study the tantric practices, but basically, it's just staying conscious when you're making love.
Staying present and feeling the energy. And
right.
And so that's the key, isn't it?
And honoring the other person.
But don't you feel, since that energy is so powerful, it's also a sort of, it can be an acceleration in that process as well? Of purification?
Yeah, that would fit in the earth category. And,
example,
if you compare it, if you make love and have an orgasm and you compare that with getting a good massage for an hour, sometimes the massage is better than the orgasm, and other times the orgasm is what you really need.
But, you know, a lot of tantric practices in the Taoists say that the male should not experience the orgasm and retain that. You don't agree with that?
Oh, that's a discipline. It's a wonderful discipline and something that's worthy of experimenting with.
Uh-huh.
But see, that in the Western world is taken out of context. The context is spiritual purification with the elements and with mantra and clearing the mind and the emotions. And so you can't just take no one discipline will do it all, and so that's why, you know, tantric masters die, is because they take it out of context.
Right, they do, but it does seem like it's an accelerated process, and I mean a valuable process, that where both the man and the woman can both achieve a level of immortality through the right type of tantric work.
Yeah, I did a 9-day training with a community in Dominican Republic in which there was about 60 people that were practicing Tantra Yoga, and their teacher was the greatest tantric master I've ever met. And in that group, there was one couple who had sex intercourse every day for 20 years without having an orgasm.
Wow. Can you mention who that teacher was, or you rather not?
His name was, he's called Master DeSoto.
Master DeSoto. I see. So, I mean, if you read those ancient texts and the Taoist texts, it seems like the Yellow Emperor, after having sex with 100 of his concubines, was able to achieve his immortal body. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. But, I mean, there is a discipline. But, of course, I think it's a very dangerous path in the sense that you build up that energy. It's easy to lose that energy as well. So, and I also think it seems like it combines all the elements, not just the earth. It seems like there's fire and water and air involved in those tantric practices.
Right. And so Master DeSoto put his system into a few chapters and added it to my Secrets of Youthing book, which is the story of my own process of how I survived senility.
Right, and that's a whole nother topic. I mean, we have a little bit of time because you're saying also senility is what sort of gets a lot of people, and they don't realize it's just part of a phase that you're saying they should or have to pass through to get beyond it. Can you go into a little more detail about that?
Yeah, senility is the final exam of the human condition. You either pass the exam or you pass away.
So explain what you mean by senility. You mean you forget your memory, you do all those things, and...
It's primarily spontaneous regression into infancy consciousness, but it also involves healing everything that you haven't healed yet. Senility is a golden opportunity to heal everything that you haven't healed yet spontaneously, in which you don't have to go to a practitioner or you don't have to go to a seminar. It just happens spontaneously, but you have to stay conscious and deal with it, similar to the way Ram Dass is working with his senility stuff.
Have you experienced that phase in your work?
Yeah, it took me 5 years to go through it from 1988 to 1993. And it was a full-time job of healing myself.
So you let yourself have the symptoms of that, and you just stayed focused on sort of a light at the end of the tunnel of working through that.
Yeah, you stay focused on my divine energy.
Right, and that will get you through it.
Yeah, and it doesn't... I mean, you can also have use practical tools. For example, the Shiva Purana, which is the oldest scriptures on the planet, which covers millions of years of human history. It recommends herbs as really an essential part of an immortal yogi's tool chest.
What, any particular herbs that you recommend?
Well, it depends on your symptoms.
Oh, I see. So, are you planning on going back to India at all to meet some of these immortals?
Yeah, actually, I have some friends that are... I'll probably be going back next December for an international conference, and then they want me to do approximately 4 9-day trainings at different cities in India after that.
You're going for a 9-day immortality conference?
Well, it's just a spiritual conference.
I see. But are you planning on seeing any of these beings when you're back there?
Well, usually when I get to India, I start hunting for them.
There's probably people you haven't found yet, right?
Yeah, I've come close to meeting Thirumular, for example.
South, right? Termala. Yeah, I have his books. Yeah, Termala. He turned into light, though, didn't he?
No, his name is pronounced Thirumular. And he's over 100 million years old.
Wow.
Along with Agastyar, who's much older. Agastyar is one of the original rishis, and he still maintains a body on the planet.
Wow. Some people say Osiris does too in Egypt. Have you heard that?
I haven't.
I've heard that.
Thirumular has somewhere between 10 and 20 successful students that are over 5,000 years old.
Wow. How do you get to... How would you actually ever even get close to finding somebody like that?
Well, when I went to Thirumular's temple in South India...
Is that in, where is that, near Pondicherry? Where is that temple?
South of Madras, and south of Pondicherry, it's called Chidambaram. And when I was there, I actually had an invitation to meet him, but I didn't, I was just too distracted, and I didn't realize that I had that invitation until it was too late.
Wow.
And I beat me.
Well, you'll have another chance to do that. Right. Is that the guy who appears at a door, or there's a door that's left open to his temple once a year for him to kind of walk through? Is that someone else?
I couldn't tell you.
Thirumular. Yeah. So they're there, they're available, but of course someone like that could be anywhere, right? You don't have to go to India, like you're saying, to achieve that. I mean, to meet that person. So basically, I mean, to wrap up here, physical immortality is a reality. It's not some theoretical idea, wishful thinking, Can you just really reinforce that so people get it, that we're...
Well, there's a group of them in the Philippines that are over 500 years old.
Wow.
There's a group of them in Andes that are several hundred years old, and there's a group of them in the mountains between Iran and Russia. Some of them are over 1,000 years old.
Wow. Do you have a book where you list all these immortal communities?
I don't.
So if someone was very serious about this and really, you know, loved being in the world and wanted to achieve that, the first thing you would tell them to do is do the element practices of the earth, air, fire, and water?
Right, to develop an awareness of the energy body and how to keep it clean and top form.
And then start to notice your death urge. Now, is the death urge a conscious thing sometimes? Can you notice it that way?
Yeah, any patterns of self-sabotage, obviously part of the death urge, and of course the gross manifestation of it is suicidal feelings.
Right. Most people don't have that, although probably all death in some way is some kind of suicide, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, people that are in extreme depression are obviously dealing with it.
Right.
When we feel hopeless and helpless, we're dealing with it.
So how do we overcome feeling hopeless and helpless? What would you suggest?
Well, we have to work with one thought and one feeling at a time. And if you're hopeless and you go spend a day with the fire, you'll probably notice that you feel a little better, more relaxed. And if you spend enough time with it, and if you add the other practices with air and water and a good diet, and especially fasting, not you know, doing it too much, so that it's self-destructive, then you'll probably feel fantastic, and your depression will, and self-sabotaging feelings will disappear.
Yeah, we have to look at our obsessive thoughts. That's also part of that self-sabotage. You know, the Buddhist non-attachment, I think, is really key in what you're talking about. And
non-attachment is a paradox.
In which way? What do you mean?
Oh, we need to have enough attachments to supply a motive to stay here.
Well, yeah, I think there is it attachment that wants us to stay here, or is it just the excitement of the next moment and new possibilities? Maybe that's an attachment.
Concrete goals.
Uh huh.
Once we clear our power, we can manifest our goals. And manifesting our goals and choosing higher and higher quality goals is what makes life interesting.
What goal do you have, for if you want to share something like that for us?
Well, I'm interested in, and I would like to see everybody in my community and my state be spiritually enlightened.
So
it's a pretty fundamental.
I like that too. Well, so just we have to just wrap up here, but tell people how to find you and if you have any trainings coming up and maybe some of the books that you've written.
Yes. The easiest book to find is Breaking a Death Habit. And my website, I have over 20 books available on my website, which is rebirthingbreathwork.com. And my phone number is 540-885-0551.
Right. And you'll be doing some trainings around the country. What's your next training workshop?
Well, I'm on my way to California for my daughter's wedding.
Oh, great. Wow.
Christmas Day. I'll be in California for a week, and then I'll be back here. And then we have trainings every week of the year available at the training center.
And the training center's in Virginia, and you could just call that number. And what's your website again, one more time, Lenore?
Rebirthingbreathwork.com.
Rebirthingbreathwork.com. Thank you, Leonard. I've been talking to Leonard Orr, the founder of Rebirthing, and very much on the road to immortality. If you want to have a copy of this show, you can look at the archives on BBS Radio or on newrealities.com. The show will be archived. My name is Alan Steinfeld. Thank you for listening. And you can email me with comments at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you, Leonard.
You're welcome.
And I will see you soon somewhere.
Good night.
Thanks.